Hello and welcome to another episode of the Richards Report. I'm Ted Richards. I'm incredibly lucky to have guests of the caliber that I do on this show, from lecturers at Wharton and Harvard Business Schools, global thought leaders like Scott Galloway, who pretty much single-handedly brought down the $46 billion WeWork IPO, to former athletes and how they're applying the life skills they learnt in their professional sporting careers into their business careers and investments. Well, in no way do I want to come across disrespectful to any of these great past guests, but I reckon this one is my all-time favourite. Some of you may know him and some of you may not. If you're a regular listener, some of you may recall the name from the amount of times that I've actually quoted him over the years. I've just realised I'm trying to build suspense with a bit of mystery, but it probably says who it is on this podcast link that you've already clicked on. Yes, I'm speaking with Morgan Housel. Morgan is a two-time winner of the Best in Business Award for the Society of American Business Editors and Writers, winner of the New York Times Sydney Award, and a two-time finalist at the Gerald Loeb Award for Distinguished Business and Financial Journalism. In my view, Morgan is the best financial writer in the world. He doesn't write about day-to-day market noise. He strikes a great balance between investing and psychology and what we can learn from both behavioral economics and also history. He has written a new book called The Psychology of Money, which is awesome. I highly encourage you to go and get it for yourself. And if you need an idea for a good Christmas present, depending on when you're listening to this episode, then I think that this is a fantastic idea. I'm not just saying that. I'm about to order about 6 copies myself. So apologies to my brothers and sisters if I've just ruined the surprise for you on Christmas Day. Morgan is in demand all over the world, so this episode was booked about 4 months ago, but trust me, it is worth the wait. As always, the usual disclosures, this episode is just for educational, informational purposes only and does not qualify as personal advice, and people may hold positions in the companies discussed. And also, as always, show notes for the episode will be available on the Six Park website, sixpark.com.au. And if it's easier, what I'm going to do from now on is I'm going to put a link to Six Park in the podcast episode description too. So you can just look there and click on the link there. Before we get into it, a big thank you to everyone that listens in and shares this podcast with friends and family. If you follow me on social media, you may have seen that the show was a finalist at Australian Podcast Awards again this year after being a finalist in 2019 too. Well, even though I didn't actually win the award for the Best Business Podcast, I just want to say thank you to all the listeners that have been on the journey with me. Please give me a rating, or even better, chuck this episode on an Instagram story or something like that, and don't forget to tag me in it. Really appreciate it. Okay, enough about me and how I almost won an award. Let's get into it. With no further ado, my name is Ted Richards. You're listening to The Richards Report. And here is my discussion with the great Morgan Housel.
You're listening to The Richards Report, where we will speak with investment experts from around the country. We will cut through the jargon to allow you to make more insightful investment decisions for your future. This is The Richards Report.
Hi, Morgan. Welcome to The Richards Report podcast.
Thanks so much.
For people listening in, Morgan is based in Seattle in the US, and we're actually just having a quick chat before I press record about what's going on here in Australia, in Melbourne, where I'm based, and what's going on in the US, and somewhat of the different approaches to managing the pandemic. But Morgan, I do want to say thank you, because for those for working with international time zones are always difficult when you're dealing with an Australian. So thanks very much for being accommodating.
I actually have to ask, I actually don't know what time it is for you right now. Can you tell me?
Okay, so it's 7 a.m. Saturday morning.
So this is reasonable. It's like noon for me and 7 a.m. for you, but that's probably about as good, as close to reasonable as we can get right now.
Yeah, and like I got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. So it's not like I'm like planning on sleeping until 9 a.m. and then deciding what I'm going to do with the day.
This is midday for you anyways. Yeah, 7 a.m. is like midday for you. So it's no worries.
I'm getting ready for dinner. All right. Morgan, you and I both had non-traditional paths into the world of investing. And not just we both had sporting backgrounds, but we both kind of took on relatively high risk and fairly dangerous sports. I went into Australian football, and I'm not even going to go down that rabbit hole and tell you what Australian football is. You went into ski racing, and I'm interested, what did ski racing teach you about what you're doing right now?
Well, yeah. So I grew up in Lake Tahoe, California. I was a competitive ski racer all throughout my childhood into my teenage years. And, you know, I didn't think it necessarily taught me anything about investing at the time. I was not interested in investing at the time whatsoever. That was my entire world was ski racing. That was all I ever thought about. But I wrote this article earlier this year, which I think is what you are leading to, which is I had this incident when I was 17 years old, where I was skiing with my two best friends who I had grown up with. For many years, we had been skiing together, you know, 6 days a week for many years. We were around each other 12 months a year. We were inseparable, and we were skiing out of bounds that day, which is when you duck under the ropes that say, do not cross, and you're not supposed to do it, but it's where all the good skiing is because it's untouched. You get fresh, untouched powder. Like that's where the good skiing is if you go out of bounds. And we had been skiing it that morning. And when we skied it that morning, we triggered a very small avalanche. Wasn't that big a deal. Didn't really go above my knees, but it was the first time I had experienced an avalanche. Of course, I was, you know, as a skier, I was aware of what they were, but I'd never actually, you know, felt what it was like. And it's a very unique experience. It's interesting because you instantly realize your feet are not on the ground anymore. Yep. You're just skiing along, and then all of a sudden you're floating, and you have no control in those situations because you cannot gain traction with your skis because the ground is pushing you rather than you pushing the ground is pushing you. So we got caught in this avalanche and didn't really think much of it. And we got to the bottom, and my friend said that they wanted to do one more lap on that same trail that we had just done that was out of bounds. We had to hitchhike back because it's, you know, the end of this out of bounds trail spit us out on a backcountry road. So we hitchhiked back. So I told my friends, hey, I don't want to do this again. I don't know why, but I said, I'm not into it. Why don't you guys go do it? And rather than hitchhiking back, I will drive around in my truck and pick you up on the other side. So you don't have to hitchhike back. To fast forward the story, not to get into a lot of the details, which I do go into in the article, but to fast forward in the story, they were killed in a massive avalanche when they went back around. And you know, they were found the next day. And of course we were 17 years old at the time. It was a very traumatic event to me. It was just completely threw my world upside down in a lot of ways. And here's what I wrote about in the article in terms of what it taught me about risk, which is this. We knew that when we skied out of bounds, it was dangerous. It was risky that we were doing something we were not supposed to do. We knew that. We were cognizant that we were taking a risk, but we always thought that the risk that we were taking meant that we might get yelled at by our coaches, or ski patrol might pull our season's passes. Maybe we would blow out our knees or break our arms, something like that. That's what we thought the consequences of the risk we were taking were. We never once in a million years thought that the consequences of the risk that we were taking meant that we would die. Never once did that cross our minds, but that's what happened. And it taught me that what really matters in life, what moves the needle, is not the average consequences of the risks you take. It's the tail. It's the like crazy out of the blue, low probability, huge impact events that move the needle. Everything else that we talk about on a daily basis as investors, what did the market do today? What is Q2 GDP growth going to be? All these things that are like average consequences don't matter. All that matters in investing is the once in a blue moon, low probability event that changes everything, like COVID-19 or yep. September 11th or the 2008 financial crisis. These like once or twice a decade, the world, you know, just like tumbles upside down and everything you thought about the world just disintegrates. That happens once or twice a decade always. And that is what moves the needle. It's not the average daily stuff that we focus on. So I think that event just made me more cognizant of tail events in the sense that, you know, it's just once or twice a decade that's really going to matter to you as an investor. And everything else, honestly, does not matter. It's just like things we're just playing a game about. And once or twice a decade, how you respond as an investor, like in March of 2020 this year, when the world was melting down when we learned about COVID, how you respond during that month is going to make all the difference in the world. But what you had done over the previous 5 or 10 years honestly didn't matter.
Morgan, in my research, there's so much there that we're going to get to. But I found it quite moving because you were 17 at the time. I actually lost a mate when I was 18, you know, relatively the same age, in an avalanche as well. So admittedly, I wasn't there, and I'm certainly can't ski like you, but it did elicit an emotion in that take me back to that experience, which we're not going to speak about today, but I just wanted to touch on that. Morgan, the next thing I want to touch on is the line between success and failure, which can be incredibly thin sometimes, be it both sport, football, games determined by 1 point, skiing, results determined by 1 second. And you touch on this in the book. And often it's simply just luck or chance that plays a role in the outcome. The question I've got for you is, why is the role of luck and chance important for people to be aware of?
Well, here's what's really important about investing. Investors are, by and large, very cognizant of risk. All they talk about all day long is risk. Is this investment risky? Is the market risky? They hire risk managers. You know, if you're a fund manager, they report risk-adjusted returns. Risk is like the center of gravity in investing. And the definition of risk, I think, is this. There are things that can happen in the world that are outside of your control that have a bigger impact on outcomes than anything you can do intentionally. That's what risk is.
Yep.
Now, what's really interesting is that that is also the definition of luck. The definition of luck is there are things that happen in the world outside of your control that have a bigger influence on outcomes than anything you do intentionally. So risk and luck are like the exact same thing, just in opposite directions. Luck is good and risk is bad. But otherwise, they are identical. And what's important, again, is that investors are keenly aware of risk, but very rarely do investors want to talk about luck. And there's two reasons for that. If I say you got lucky, I kind of look like a jerk. I kind of look like I'm jealous of you. Like I'm, you know, like I'm just dismissive of someone else's success. It doesn't look good on me. And if I say I myself got lucky, that's hard for me to swallow. I don't want to look in the mirror every morning and just say, oh, you just got lucky. I want to think that whatever success I've had is because of what I did intentionally. Everyone wants to think that. So even though luck and risk are the same thing, we are keenly aware of risk and we consistently push luck under the rug, pretend it doesn't exist. Don't want to pay much attention to it as it pertains to it. Business success, investing success. And what you mentioned earlier about the thin line between success and failure, you know, the traits that you need to do very well in business and in investing are the same traits that can lead to business and investing failure. Like taking a risk, like doing something where the odds of success are not necessarily in your favor, but have a huge payoff if they do land in your favor. Those are the same traits that can lead to big success or big failures. And I think we do harm to ourselves sometimes when we look up to businesses or investors and we want to admire them. We want to say, what did Elon Musk do? What did Warren Buffett do? What did Apple and Amazon, Jeff Bezos, what did they do? And I think that's fine, but it's so easy to discount any level of luck that they had in their success that could have gone a very different way. Here's one example that I will give. Cornelius Vanderbilt, one of the most successful, richest business tycoons in human history. He was adjusted for inflation. His net worth was like $250 billion. He was just like off the charts successful. But if you read his biography about how he got rich, what he did in the business world, his business strategy was to break the law. That was why he was successful. It's because he was more willing than his competition to break the law and to pay, and to like ravage the court system and completely, you know, like push aside any sort of any legal precedents. He was just willing to push the boundaries more than other people. And that was a big part of his success. Now, it is easy to look at that and realize that his story could have turned out much different. And rather than today, us, you and I, looking at him as a business tycoon, it easily could have been that you and I are reading about some guy in the 1800s who ended up in jail because he was a crook. The story easily could have been that. John D. Rockefeller is another person. Was he a very smart and wise businessman? Yes. But if you go back and read his story, he too was breaking the law left and right. And you could imagine his story ending up as not the richest man in history, but as a crook. It could have been that. And like it's easy to hear me say that and say, no, he was so smart and shrewd, but it so easily could have gone the other way. And I think we underestimate how close some extreme results could have been from going the other way. And that is true in the other direction as well. There are, you know, let's just take the hedge fund long-term capital management, which, you know, for people who aren't familiar, was a very big hedge fund in the 1990s, staffed by the smartest people in the industry. They had Nobel laureates on the team and they went bankrupt in 1998. Yeah. The hedge fund exploded and went bankrupt. That too could have gone the other way. They could have been the next Renaissance Technologies if things have just gone slightly different. They could have been the most successful investors of all time. And so it's easy for you and I today to look at that and say, these idiots, they took too much risk. They didn't know what they were doing. These bozos. It so easily could have gone the other way. So I think we in general, everyone, including myself, is too quick to jump to conclusions that people who are successful did the right thing and people who are not successful did the wrong thing. It's too easy to jump to that because the line is so thin.
Morgan, I love your examples, and I'm going to speak to some of the more examples that you use in the book. But what one you did touch on then was Amazon and Bezos. And everyone can points to that as being the best example ever of this fantastic business. But there has been some certain amount of luck there too along the way, in that I'm pretty sure Jeff has closed funding rounds just before significant events like the dot-com crash, where they've done funding rounds, they've got some more runway, and it's been able to get them through those periods. And if there was just a change of 6 months here or there, those funding rounds would look incredibly different, if not catastrophic. And
may have killed the company.
You may have killed the company.
And maybe you could say, I don't know this, but maybe you could say the fact that he did the round then was foresight. Yeah, maybe he saw what was coming. I don't know that to be the case, but maybe. But you're right. Like, and whether it's, I think sometimes luck is the wrong word because it has a negative connotation. Yeah. I think chance is probably a better word, that there are just chances in how the world works and how outcomes happen that are easy to ignore, even with hindsight. So my takeaway for all this is just that we need to be careful in terms of who we admire. And to the extent that we admire people or businesses or investors, we need to take like the biggest, broadest takeaways from their lessons rather than the really fine lessons, the really specific lessons that are too specific to their outcome and contain a degree of luck that you and I or anyone else could not emulate in the future.
So that's luck and chance, which investing can, you know, is all about investing and also sport too. But there's something else that I want to speak about, and that is the importance of controlling your mindset and your behavior. You actually open the book with a comparison between two people, which contrasts their mindset and behavior. Can you tell us a bit about that story and, in fact, why you chose to open with this story?
So sure. There's two investors who I profile in the introduction, named Richard Reed, who was this super humble, low-key, down-to-earth person. He spent his entire career as a janitor and a gas station attendant. He just was not a very exciting guy. No one really thought that much of him. But when he died, he left millions of dollars to charity. And it turned out that there was no secret. There was no inheritance or lottery winnings or anything like that. Richard Reed just took what little he could save from his job as a janitor, and he invested it in blue chip companies, and he let it compound for like 60 years. That was his whole story. And then I compare that to another guy named Richard, who had almost the exact opposite outcome. He was born into a wealthy family. He went to Harvard. He went to University of Chicago. He went to work on Wall Street. He became a vice chairman of Merrill Lynch. Super successful Wall Street career, made a ton of money. And then he went bankrupt in 2010. Just around the same time that Richard, that Ronald Reed, I should say, died. So what's interesting about this is that you have one person who has no education, no training, no background, no experience, and he massively outperforms someone who has the best training, the best experience, the best background, the best training. And I just think that does not happen in any other field, where someone with no experience, no analytical skills can outperform someone who has the best analytical skills. And I think the reason that it occurs is because Ronald Reed had mastered the psychology of money, the behavioral part of investing, in the sense that he was patient. He had a long-term mindset. He was diversified. He let compounding work. He just left it alone and let it go. Whereas Richard, I think, did not master the behavioral side of investing. He took on too much debt. He was overly optimistic. He didn't manage his cash flow. Like, a lot of that was just a behavioral thing. So there are very few fields in which someone who has all the analytical skills but none of the behavioral skills, you know, we'll end up with outcomes like that. And it just highlights to me that doing well in investing is not about what you know. It's not about how smart you are, where you went to school, how sophisticated your models are. It's not any of that. It's overwhelmingly just about how you behave. Like, it's your relationship with greed and fear and your ability to take a long-term mindset and how gullible you are, who you trust. That is what moves the needle in investing more than anything else. And it's easy. What's important about this is that it's very easy to sweep that under the rug. Like, particularly smart, educated people in this industry want to spend their time talking about the analytical side, the really complicated data and math and formulas, which is all good stuff. But the behavioral side just seems too like kindergarten, soft, sweeping under the rug. Like, it doesn't seem like it should be that important, even if it makes a much bigger difference than the analytical side of investing that we pay attention to.
It's a great point, Morgan. When we talk about finance and investing, many people assume that just simply involves a calculator or Microsoft Excel to come to a number which determines whether it's an, you know, to invest or not, and that's where it ends. But that that behavioral side in terms of how you act is so important too, which kind of touches on my next point, which you use analogies and moments from history to support your points, which I think is what I enjoy most about your writing. And it's what makes this book entertaining, not just educational. But onto that behavior. At one point in the book, you touch on the behavior of dogs and how everyone kind of accepts that they still retain certain behaviors from their ancestors from, like, you know, 10,000 years ago. Yet humans, we think that 20 years of experience in one specific area is enough to eliminate any of these behavior traits or you know, from evolution or our ancestors. Once again, why is that important to be aware of?
First of all, what I love about you bringing that point up is that I had to battle to let me leave that line in the book. I thought it was such a good line, and they didn't, but I loved it. The fact that dogs were domesticated 10,000 years ago, but they still retain behaviors of their ancestors. But in the modern financial world, which has only existed for like 20 or 30 years in the United States, we expect that we're going to be perfectly acclimated.
Yep.
And I think, you know, particularly in the United States, it's different in Australia, different in Europe. Every country has their own little quirks. But in the United States, it has only been the last 30 years or so that most people have been expected to save for their own retirement and to invest their money in their own retirement accounts. Before, about 30 years ago, you either had a pension where someone else did it for you, or you just worked until you died, which was the more common case for people. It's only been, you know, within the United States, a 401k and the IRA, those kind of vehicles have not existed for that long. The Roth IRA, which is one of the biggest retirement vehicles in the United States, didn't exist until 1998. It's a pretty young thing that we're dealing with. So it should not come as a surprise that people are not very good at investing, because we're new to this. We're brand new doing this. And we don't have the generational knowledge transfer that we do for other things. Like, you know, my parents taught me how to drive a car, and their parents, my grandparents taught my parents how to drive. And so you have this generational knowledge transfer of how you like learn to do things in life. And we just don't have that in investing, because even my parents, when they were my age, that they would need to save for their retirement, save for their kids' education, invest in index funds. Like, that's just, that idea didn't exist. So we're brand new to this. And that's why I think we're so bad at it on average across the industry.
Morgan, a lot of those 401k, Roth IRA, they're very much specific to America and Australia. We've got our superannuation system over here, and we've got, yep, I've got predominantly an Australian audience. So, but once again, very similar. I think, to be fair, I think we were one of the first in the world to introduce the superannuation system that we have, which we are very lucky to have. But it's not like this was happened 100 years ago. It just happened like maybe, you know, 10 years before the US or something like that. So depending on how old you are, I believe this is something where our grandparents didn't have. Our parents probably were trying to work it out as they were going. But once again, like, we don't have the generational educational transfer. Many of us are still trying to work it out as we go.
And this is true in the United States for something like student loans as well, where we have $1.5 trillion of student loans. A lot of that reason is because my parents' generation, by and large, when they went to college in the 1970s and 80s, college was either free or it was very, very cheap. So the idea that you need to save $250,000 to send your kids to college, for my parents' generation, that idea didn't exist. And then when my generation got to college, and for a private university that cost $250,000, my parents' generation across, you know, the whole country was kind of like, well, what do? We didn't save any money for our kids. So that, I guess our kids have to go into student debt now. And that is why we have so much debt. It was just like a difference in generations in terms of, you know, what was expected for people to do financially that led us to this gap.
I want to unpack another difference between the US and Australia, in that I'll start off by saying I'm 37, a 37-year-old Australian. And whilst we're in a recession here in Australia, or we've just been through a recession, I'm conscious I've experienced something that no American ever has. And that is, you know, 30 years of sustained economic growth. And,
yes.
And there's, yep, there's two things. I think you actually might even reference that in the book. There's two things that I want to speak about here. The first one, I'm conscious that I am lucky. And from your perspective, I'm interested, what do you think the typical American, once they hear an Australian has been 30 years without a recession, what do you think the typical American thinks life is like in Australia?
Let me take this a slightly different way.
Okay.
Because it's a great question, but here's what comes to mind when you say that. When I travel overseas to Australia or South Africa or Europe or Asia, wherever it is, what blows my mind as an American is how cognizant everyday people on the street are of foreign exchange rates. You go to anywhere else, you go to Korea, you go to South Africa, you go to Australia, people know what the dollar exchange rate is. And if you go to the United States, even smart, educated people who work in finance never think one second about the dollar exchange rate. It's just not relevant to them in the slightest. But I go to South Africa and the cab driver knows like what the exchange rate was an hour ago. And I think our experience in the United States is we have had the world's reserve currency since the end of World War II. And therefore it doesn't, like, a dollar to us is just a dollar. There's no exchange. A dollar is just a dollar. That's what it is. So that's like, everyone has different experiences based off of what they've experienced. And that is what shocks me when I travel. I think if you talk to an average American and said, what is life like in Australia? I think what's really interesting, I'm not proud of this. This is not a good thing, but I think it's true. Americans have been indoctrinated for decades that we're the best. Yep. It's true. Like, for a lot of things, there are some instances where maybe that's true. There's a lot where it's just distinctly not true, but we've believed that we are. So I think if you asked most Americans, what is life like in Australia? We would say it's pretty good, but not as good as we have it in America. And I think that is something that is just analytically not true, that there are a lot of things that you have in Australia that were better than ours, including, I believe, your long-term stock market returns exceed ours in the United States, as they do in South Africa. South Africa's long-term inflation-adjusted stock market is better than the United States, going back like 100 years. And I believe it is. I think there's only a couple of countries where that's the case. I think Australia is one of them.
Probably both heavily in the resource areas, I'd imagine.
Yes. And so I think there are a lot of things where people in the United States are just kind of ignorant that there are other countries that do things quite well. And the fact that Australia went 30 years without a recession, a lot of that, as you kind of referenced, was mining resources, kind of, you know, riding the China boom. But you know, we've had in the last 30 years in the United States, we've had 1, 2, 3, 4 recessions, two of which were god awful and, like, you know, did significant damage to the population.
The reason why I brought that up, it wasn't to try and get on my high horse or anything like that, but it's actually the reason why I bring it up is it's got to do with something you touch on in your last chapter, and that is how we compare ourselves to others, because you know, you hear a country's gone 30 years without a recession, you might assume that everyone's just happy and loving life. And but as with the US, you know, the increase in wealth hasn't been experienced across the board in the same way. And where I want to go with this is, and sorry for the big kind of run up here, but what happened in the US in the 70s when people started to become aware that wealth wasn't as equal as it once was?
I think what really happened here is we have to take it back to the end of World War II.
Yep.
And at the end of World War II, through about the 1970s, there was a lot of economic growth in the United States and around the world. And in the United States, it was fairly equal. People who had lower incomes, their incomes grew at the same percentage rate. The growth rate was the same, if not higher, than rich people. So there was a lot of equalness and togetherness. And even in terms of consumption, there's this great kind of anecdote that I love that I found in a book where it says poor people drove Chevys and rich people drove Cadillacs, which are not that different. Like, the Cadillac is a little bit nicer, but people listen to the same music. They watch the same TV shows. They read the same books, regardless of how rich you were. There was much more just like equalness in society where people were growing together. That started to change in the 1980s when income inequality really took off. And then the incomes adjusted for inflation for the majority of the population stagnated, if not declined. And then for a small minority of the population, not only grew, but just surged through the sky. And I think what that did, it was something really important, which is this: people judge their well-being based relative to those around them. So in the post-World War II period, most people judged their well-being and looked around and said, hey, my neighbors, most people in my town are doing the same as I am. We're driving the same cars. We're driving the same homes. We're doing the same thing. Like, we're all equal, relatively. After income inequality really started to surge, then it was different. Then people just started looking around saying, hey, Tom, this guy in town, he's driving a Lamborghini and his house is 10,000 square feet and he's sending his kids to Harvard. And it inflated the aspirations of people who did not make as much money. since people judge their well-being based off of those around them, once you had started getting very rich people in society, it inflated the aspirations of everyone else whose incomes did not keep up with that. And the only way that they could close that gap between saying, hey, Tom sent his kids to Harvard, so I deserve to send my kids to Harvard. But if you don't earn as much money as Tom, the only way you can close that gap is with debt. And that began the huge consumer debt boom that started in the 1980s, where all kinds of debt, credit card debt, mortgage debt, student loans just exploded. I think a lot of that is just people trying to close the social gap between them and a small slice of legitimately wealthy Americans who inflated their material aspirations. I think that's a big explanation for why debt got so out of control. And of course, that debt boom caused the 2008 financial crisis. It led to, I think you can also tie that to the rise of Brexit, the rise of Donald Trump in many ways. It just led to a kind of a breaking of society that you can, I truly believe you can tie the roots back to the post-World War II period that created the sense of all of society growing together. Even if there's big differences in between rich people and wealth people, the idea that we're kind of in this, we're playing the same game and growing at the same rate broke in the 1980s. It had a lot of consequences.
That's another reason why I love your book, in that it is a book about investing and very much on the topic of finance. But the ripples, you know, do kind of extend into just how we live our lives. And there are so many gold nuggets throughout the book. Morgan, also within the book, you touch on fields where you kind of got to be perfect every time. Let's say it's something like being a pilot of an airplane. And then there are fields that you want to be at least pretty good nearly all the time, like our former careers, you know, be it ski racing or football, where you want to win far more than you lose. But investing is different. Morgan, what happens if you always try and be the best? You always want to be perfect when you invest.
I think what's important about investing, this is true whether you are a stock picker or you're investing in funds, regardless of what it is that a very small minority of the decisions that you make and the investments that you pick will drive the vast majority of your lifetime returns. So hypothetically, if you pick 100 stocks and hold them for 20 years, hypothetically, probably what will happen is you will lose most, if not all, of your money on about 40 of them. And maybe 5 to 10 of them will account for all of your returns. And your returns overall will probably be pretty good, even though you lost all of your money on 40% of the stocks that you picked and you thought were going to be great. That is the normal distribution of how things work out over a long period of time. It is not intuitive to think that that's going to be the case. It's not intuitive to think that if you pick the 100 best companies in the world, 40% of what you pick are going to go bankrupt. That seems like you did something wrong, like you made a mistake. But it's not. That's how the distribution works over time. And this is true for even the best investors in the world. Warren Buffett, Benjamin Graham, George Soros, go on down the list. They make the majority of their lifetime career returns off of a tiny number of investments that they've made. Benjamin Graham, kind of the godfather of value investing, and one of the most famous investors of all time, 100% of his career success as an investor can be tied to one investment that he made in Geico. If you take out Geico from his track record, his career returns are average. And I think that's more normal than you would think. And it's true in business as well, where, you know, take a company like Amazon. They've experimented with hundreds of different products over time, but basically only two products that they've made move the needle, make a difference. It's AWS and Prime. Those are the products that made Amazon what it is. But they've tried to do hundreds. They tried to do the Fire Phone. They tried to do all kinds of things that didn't work, that failed. But that's okay. As long as a couple of them that do incredibly well make up the difference, that's how growth works. So it's never intuitive in investing to think that you can be consistently wrong and still do fine, or very often wrong and still do just great over time. It's much easier in those situations to take a step back and think that you did something wrong, you made a mistake, versus accepting that, you know, whether it's a portfolio construction or market volatilities and annual returns, that you are going to make the majority of your success during a minority of the time is a really fundamental part of investing history that's not intuitive or easy to wrap your head around.
Morgan, we could speak about your book for ages, but I really think the best thing that someone can actually do is go out and buy it. I'm gonna give so many copies out to my extended family at Christmas, which is coming up. Morgan, correct me if I'm wrong, but the book has been so successful so quickly, and a lot of these educational stories are so interesting. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is a movie going to be made about this? And if I'm right, how was that when you found that out?
Yes, you are right. It was as shocking to me as it was everyone else. And I don't have any experience doing something like that. So it was all kind of new to me, but it's wild. A guy named Dana Brunetti, who is the executive producer of House of Cards and 50 Shades of Grey and The Social Network and a bunch of other big movies, reached out and said he read the book and wanted to turn it into a film. And of course, I don't have any experience with stuff like that, so I needed to go out and hire some help with me and to help me through that process. But we got it done, and it'll be cool to see what happens. There's not a lot of filming that takes place right now because of COVID, but I think, you know, next year, maybe in the year after that, we'll see what comes of it. And I wish I could speak more about it, but I don't, not because I'm hiding anything, just because I don't know how the process works. So I'm as confused and as shocked by it as anyone else.
I'm certainly not shocked in that, because I just think it is so entertaining, also educational, as I touched on earlier. Morgan, any idea kind of the platform that people might be able to watch it on? Is it going to be like on a Netflix, or is it going to be on an American network?
I think that's to be determined. That's kind of the next step in the process that will happen from here. So that's yet to be settled on, but that's the next thing to figure out.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll keep my listeners up to date, if and when how it's going, but I strongly encourage, in the meantime, go out and get the book. Morgan, moving away from the book to your newsletters, which is how I first came across your writing. Some of the greatest fund managers in the world subscribe to your newsletter. I believe Howard Marks often quotes you, and with all the contacts that you have in the industry, you could call up any fund manager and have a discussion with them, no doubt. But you choose to invest in index funds and ETFs. Can you tell me why ETFs work for you and how you like to invest?
Yes. So there's a few disclaimers that I want to add to this beforehand, which is that how I invest works for me, but yep. I'm not recommending that other people do it. And that's not a legal disclaimer. That's truly just like my philosophy, that just because it works for me doesn't mean this is the right thing for you. But to me, here's what's important. Here's why I invest in indexes. I'm not a passive investing zealot. I'm not one of the people who thinks that no one can beat the market, so don't even try. That's not me. But what I think is true is that the big results in investing come from time. It's not necessarily how good of an investor you are. It's how long can you stay invested for that creates the big fortunes over time. So for me, the one variable that I want to focus on and maximize for is time and endurance. All I want to focus on for my personal finances is, can I stay invested in the stocks that I own for 40 years? That's my investing philosophy. That's all I want to do. And if I can achieve that, I think I'm going to check off every financial goal that I have for my family and then some. That's all I want to do. And I think the odds of success for endurance increase if you have a simpler investing strategy. If you have a complicated investing strategy that needs constant nurturing and you need to be fiddling with the knobs every month, every year, trying to figure out what should you do next, what sector is going to do next, what's support, that just increases the odds that you will not be able to maintain it over time. Versus if I have a passive strategy, I don't have to do anything to it. I can just leave it alone, and that increases the odds that I can let it compound for 40 years, which is, to me, that's going to generate the biggest dollar amount of returns. So when people see that I'm a passive investor, a lot of people say like, oh, don't you want to invest with the best investors? Don't you want to beat the market, et cetera? It's not that I don't. It's that I think the odds of success are highest if I can keep it the simplest. For me, that's what it is for me. So that's why I invest the way that I do. Even if I am fully aware that I know of investors who can beat the market this year, next year, over the next 10 years, I do. But I don't invest with them because even if they are likely to do better than the market, they would increase the odds for me personally that I would have to abandon them at some point, which would screw up how compounding works. There's a great quote from Charlie Munger where he says, the first rule of compounding is to never interrupt it unnecessarily. That to me is like the basis, the foundation of how I invest my own money.
And now a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by SixPark. SixPark is one of Australia's leading online investment management services. They take you through a risk assessment online and set you up with your own globally diversified portfolio of exchange-traded funds, or ETFs. You'll be invested in Australian and international equities, infrastructure, fixed income, global property, and other asset classes too. Your portfolio is then overseen by the SixPark Investment Advisory Committee that is chaired by Brian Watson, a former Board of Guardians for the Australian Government Future Fund, Lindsay Tanner, the former Minister of Finance for the Australian Government, and Mark Nicholson, who headed up an investment division for the World Bank. If you'd like to find out more, go to sixpark.com.au or click on the link within this episode description. Okay, back to my discussion with Morgan.
So, Morgan, that's your book, and that's how you invest your money. It wouldn't be a podcast in 2020 if we didn't touch on COVID. So, quick question here. And what we've seen in 2020 with COVID is that sad news happens quickly in terms of being on the news. But good news, such as like on the vaccine front, has been so small over the course of this year that it certainly hasn't counted for all the bad news. Progress still has been made, but it's not newsworthy. And this reminds me of one of your lines, which you put in the book: progress happens too slowly to notice, but setbacks happen too quickly to ignore. Morgan, why is this important for people to be aware of?
I think just like the observation that there are no overnight miracles, but there are lots of overnight tragedies, is really important in just terms of setting your mindset around optimism and pessimism over time. It is easy to be a pessimist because the bad things that happen in the world happen so quickly that you can't ignore them. Yep. They're always in the news. They happen overnight. And you say, oh, this company went out of business. There's a new pandemic. These things that happen very quickly, you can't look away. But the good news that is more powerful than the bad news over time happens very slowly. It's stocks compounding a little bit every year, so little that you don't pay attention to it. But over 20 years, you just made 10 times your money. It's things like changes in life expectancy that at any given year, no one pays any attention to. You know, life expectancy goes up 1 or 2% per year. No one cares. But over a generation, we're so much healthier now than we were 50 or 100 years ago. But it happens slowly, too slowly to ignore. And I think this is why more people are pessimistic than they should be. Because what is easiest to pay attention to are the setbacks and the problems. And it's hard to pay attention to. It takes effort to pay attention to the really good things that compound slowly over time. But compounding works is so powerful that even if something is only improving 2 or 3% per year, in any given year, you don't notice it. But over the course of your lifetime, it's going to be completely revolutionary and change how we live, change our life expectancy, change our happiness, et cetera. So I think that observation is just fundamental to being a long-term optimist. You can be a long-term optimist and still recognize that the short term is going to be a mess. It is going to be difficult. There's going to be problems and setbacks and recessions and bear markets and pandemics, and still recognize that over the long term, we're not only going to be okay, we're going to do great. It takes effort to like reconcile those two. They seem like they're conflicting points. But I think if you look historically, that's how it should be. You should be a pessimist about the short run because that's normally what it is. And you should be an optimist about the long run because that's normally what it is as well. Not an easy thing to do to reconcile those two things, but I think it's really important over time.
Well, we're not through the pandemic yet, but hopefully 2020 kind of in a small time period has kind of taught us that compared to where we were in March and where we find ourselves at the time of recording in November. Still got more to come, but possibly see a bit of light at the end of the tunnel. Morgan, a quote I read that you once said, "The biggest innovations rarely occur when everyone's happy and safe or when the future looks bright. They happen when people are a little panicked, worried, and when the consequences of not acting quickly are too painful to bear. That's when the magic happens." And why I highlighted that and wanted to speak to you about that is, any idea what innovation is going to come out of 2020? And I'm conscious that no one's got a crystal ball, but I am interested in your thoughts here.
I think just the general observation that the biggest technologies come during periods of panic, particularly if you look at modern history.
Yep.
World War II and the Cold War did more to scientific advancement than anything else before or since. Just something simple like penicillin. Penicillin was discovered in 1929. That's when we first discovered that it has antibacterial properties. But it wasn't until World War II that general said, "Hey, we got all these wounded soldiers who are dying of infection. Hey, do you guys have something that we can like, yes, let's give it to them," that we started manufacturing penicillin in a real way. Now, penicillin has saved more lives than people died in World War II. It's crazy to wrap your head around something like that, that you had this shock to the system that incentivized us to create something so important during this terrible period. And also things like jet airplanes and rockets and nuclear power, et cetera, that would not have occurred if it weren't for this disastrous event in World War II, but that set up these technologies to give you and I and everyone else a great life afterwards. Like technologies happen when people are incentivized like that to go out and really scramble to figure out a solution because the cost of not doing so is so high. So what is it going to be with COVID? It's definitely going to be something. I think historically the answer is you don't know. It's only obvious in hindsight. Yep. No one in 1945 would have said, well, jet airplanes are going to make it so that I can fly to Australia in 10 hours. Like no one was saying that back then, but that's what occurred. It is impressive already that, you know, we've gotten news in the last week from Pfizer and Moderna that we have good vaccines that work and that appear safe. And we did that in 10 months. That if you go back to earlier this year, people were saying, look, most vaccines take a decade to create. They take a decade to create. We did it in 10 months. I think something like that is going to have a profound impact on the future. Like what we learn this year medically and biologically is going to have a profound impact on the future. I'm not an expert in this in the slightest, but my understanding is that mRNA, which is the vaccines that Pfizer and Moderna are based off of, also have a big impact on future kind of these emerging cancer treatments as well. And that like, so my question would be, what have we learned about mRNA vaccines, mRNA technology in 2020? That is also going to massively improve our ability to treat cancer and other diseases. That to me would probably be the most likely positive shock from 2020, from COVID-19, is learning something medically and biologically and pharmaceutically that will have a big impact on disease mortality, positive impact on mortality over the coming generation.
That would be exciting. Morgan, your book is available everywhere. So people listening in Australia, it's called The Psychology of Money, as I touched on before. Christmas holiday is coming up, so strongly encourage you to check it out. And if there's someone in the family that you think may appreciate it, I highly encourage you to chuck it under the tree. And what I do love, Morgan, it's not a long read too. Like it's got fantastic stories where you get a message and then it moves on to the next. I assume that this was intentional.
Yes, it was intentional because I'm a big reader. I read a lot of books, but I don't finish many books, which is true for a lot of people. And the reason is that, you know, most topics do not require 300 pages of explanation to get your point across. It's rarely the case that you need a book's length of material to get your point across. So my goal for this book was, and there's no way for me to measure this. I never know, but I wanted to maximize for how many people not only buy the book and start the book, but how many people finish the book. That's what I want to do. That for myself as a reader, the only way that I finish a book is if the author is not rambling. Like, make your point, make it a good point, and then get out of my way. That's what I, as a reader, that's what I want. So I just always kept that in mind when I was writing as well. Like, I want to make my point. I hope it's a good point. I want to use an example to reiterate the point. And then as soon as I'm done with the point, I'm done. The chapter's over. I'm moving on. There's one chapter in the book that is one page long. And when I turned it into the publisher, they said, this must be a mistake. Are we missing something here? Did you leave something out? And I said, no, that's all I have to say on this point. I think it's a good point, but I have nothing else to say. So that's it. One page, we're done. Moving on. And I'm actually proud of that chapter because that to me is the indication that I held true to my goal of wasting as little of your time as possible.
Well, I loved it. And it actually reminded me of the book that I'm reading for the kids right now, put into bed. It's The Twits by Roald Dahl. And every now and then, because yes. I read him a chapter a night, and every now and then there's a chapter that it goes for one or two pages, and I just go, yes, bang, in and out.
See, that's anyway. Another thing. There's this psychology of reading where the reader wants to feel like they're making progress, and they measure progress by chapter.
Yep.
So if you read a short chapter, and you're like, great, I just finished another chapter. I'm making progress here. This is good. It's a positive feeling that keeps you in the game, keeps you reading.
Morgan, the other thing about... apart from your book, I want people to be aware of is your newsletters. So if you're interested, Morgan is a partner at the CoLab Fund. So please sign up for that newsletter if you're interested in finding out more. And Morgan, the other area that I love following you and your thoughts and your opinions is on Twitter. And so you can be found at Morgan Housel. Morgan, very, very quickly, your thoughts on Twitter.
I think Twitter is the best communication device ever created. And like a lot of things, it's so good that it's dangerous. I mean, what is something that where like my, I don't sleep as well as I would want. I wish if there's one thing in my life that I wish I could improve upon, it's my sleep. I don't sleep that well. And I kid you not, I'm not exaggerating. I think part of my problem is if I wake up at 2 a.m, the first thing that pops in my mind is let's check Twitter. And I hate that. It's gross. It's disgusting. But that's what it is. Like, so Twitter is wonderful. but it also has this addictive quality to it, as a lot of social media does. That to me, it feels like I wish I could improve upon it, but the reason I'm addicted to it is it's so good. You're just connected to the minds of people all over the world who are telling you what they think at any given moment. Like, it's such a good communication tool in terms of how it's laid out and the pithiness of it. I love Twitter, but sometimes I love it a little too much.
Yeah, I'm the same. And what I like about it is similar to the point you made before. It's succinct. People make their point. You follow who you're interested in. Anyway, I'm not here to flog Twitter. Morgan, I've had a great chat. I've been looking forward to this so much. Thank you very much for chatting on the Richards Report.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay, that's it for this episode. There's more big name guests on the way, so don't forget to subscribe to the show if you haven't already. It's free. And don't forget to chuck the episode on an Instagram story and tag me in it too. I really appreciate it. Unless, of course, it's negative feedback, then maybe keep that one to yourself. Okay, I'm rambling now. See you next time on The Richards Report.